Now, today I want to start out asking you a question, okay? The question is this: is sex necessary?
Yes.
Yes.
100%.
Of course it is.
All the guys.
Okay. So next question for all of you that answered yes, okay? We're going to ask you another question. What is sex? We don't get any response out of that answer, right? If you guys are in college, you ought to know what sex is by now, right?
If we want to get real gross, like...
Actually, it's not real gross. What is sex? Yeah.
It's just a way to reproduce, basically.
Okay, so... Basically, you're really close. When we talk about sex, really all it is it's when gametes from two different individuals fuse. Okay, so that's what sex is, technically speaking. So when President Clinton said he didn't have sex with that woman, right? Okay, he actually told the truth. Okay, no gametes fused, at least not that we're aware of, right? And so. And technically, what most of you think of as sex is actually not sex, okay? What most of you think of as sex is coitus or copulation, all right? Sex is actually when the gametes fuse, and that happens quite rarely. So, you know, somebody asks you if you've been having sex with somebody else, unless zygote, which is, you know, the fusion of a gamete and an ovum occur, or a sperm and an ovum in the case of a human, technically you haven't had sex. Okay? Alright? So now that you know what sex is, which is kind of interesting, you know, I tried this with a biology class once, a general biology class, and about 98% of the students didn't know how to define sex, which is really interesting. So the question now is sex necessary?
Yes.
Yes. If you want a test tube baby, yeah.
Even if you have a test tube baby in humans, it is a result of sex. So in some organisms, such as humans, sex is necessary for reproduction to occur. However, in other organisms, there is something that we call asexual reproduction. Okay. So there are some organisms that can reproduce without sex. And when there is no sex in reproduction, we call it asexual reproduction, which means no sex. Now, there are a number of different types of asexual reproduction we're going to talk about today. The first is what we call vegetative asexual reproduction. If I can get the overhead projector to come on. Vegetative asexual reproduction is actually quite common in plants. Okay, not all plants can reproduce vegetatively, but there are quite a few different plants that can reproduce vegetatively. For example, we talked about one earlier, and there's a picture of it back here in the classroom, quaking aspen. They reproduce vegetatively more commonly than they reproduce sexually. All right. So what vegetative asexual reproduction is this. If we have, and a lot of grasses, actually, most of you experience this with grass. Do any of you golf? Okay, when you golf, you know, if you're like me, you put a few divots in the grass, the golf course, right, periodically. And when you come back a month later to the same golf course, are those divots still there? No, is it because they've come in and put turf down on those divots? Unless you made a big divot on the green, which you're not supposed to do, right? But are they there? They're not, and that's because long grass, what we typically think of as long grass, also reproduces vegetatively. So what happens is you have a piece of grass here, and what it does is it grows an underground horizontal stem called a rhizome. Okay, and then what happens is another grass plant grows, okay, with roots, everything else. Right? Same thing is true with quaking aspen trees. And then what happens is if you were to come in and cut this rhizome with a shovel, both of those grass plants would survive. And so therefore, they're each individual plants. Does that make sense to everybody? So they're not, they're a result of asexual reproduction. Both of these plants, however, are genetically identical to one another. Okay, they're clones of one another. And so when we talk about quaking aspen trees, we talk about quaking aspen clones. I think I mentioned this before this semester, earlier on in the semester, that when quaking aspen trees bud out in the spring, there's a group of trees or a clone that will all bud at the same time, and that clone will also change their leaves in the fall at the same time, right? Okay. So those are clones. And actually, vegetatively, using a rhizome or an underground horizontal stem to allow for reproduction is the most common type of vegetative reproduction. There are some plants, actually, that have above-ground horizontal stems. So come up and across like this. There's actually some grass that have these. These are called a stolon, the above-ground horizontal stem. Probably the best-known plant, well, the one that most students are most familiar with, that reproduce using a stolon is a strawberry plant. You ever seen strawberry plants? They put those runners, some people call them runners. Technically they're called stolons, and then a new strawberry plant can grow asexually. Okay? Any questions about vegetative asexual reproduction? The second type of asexual reproduction that we have on our list here is budding. Some organisms only reproduce via budding. Again, the organisms that are the result of that budding are clones of one another. Okay. Now, the types of organisms that would bud, at least probably the ones that you might most commonly think of, include bacteria. Okay. So if you have a bacterium here, how is it going to reproduce? Well, bacteria don't go through meiosis. Okay, there's no meiosis in bacteria. And so simply they go through mitotic division, essentially is what they do, and you get two brand new clones of that bacterium. Okay. So what are some of the advantages? We're going to talk about these others here in a minute, but what are some of the advantages of reproducing asexually? Why would a plant or a bacterium want to do that? Okay, you don't have to have a mate, so it's a lot more energy efficient, right? Okay, what else? Yeah.
There are fewer chances for mutations.
Okay, there's fewer chances for mutations, which can be a good thing or a bad thing. Okay, what else? Can bacteria reproduce very quickly? Yeah, so if you asexually reproduce, you can reproduce much more quickly to adapt to your environment than if you reproduce sexually, right? Okay, so it's a much quicker process. What are the disadvantages, though, of asexual reproduction? Or you could say, what are the advantages of sexual reproduction? I mean, really, if we talk about the advantages of asexual reproduction, those are also disadvantages of sexual reproduction, right? Okay. So, vice versa, what are the disadvantages of asexual reproduction?
No gene combination.
Okay. No combination of genes. Okay, so everybody's clones, and as a result of asexual reproduction. And, you know, some people would say it's not as much fun, but anyways, there's no recombination of genes. Now, why is gene recombination important? And that's the big advantage of sexual reproduction. Why is it important?
Different kinds. Maybe they'll be more susceptible to different kinds of diseases, or, you know, more immune.
Okay. So if you have a whole bunch of different types of individuals, you may not be as susceptible to diseases. Okay. So for example, if you get a bacterial infection, we know now that bacteria reproduce asexually, so they're all clones. If you get a bacterial infection, can you get an antibiotic that kills all of one type of bacteria?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's kind of a disadvantage, right? I mean, if everybody's clones and there's some disease or some antibiotic that gets introduced into the population, it can do what? It can wipe out the entire population. Does that make sense to everybody? Whereas if you have different genes that we get in sexual reproduction, then what happens is you get more diversity. So say, for example, if there was a disease that hadn't been introduced into our population for quite some time, if we introduced it into this classroom, it may kill 80% of us, right? But there may be 20% of us that might survive because our genes are resistant to that type of disease. Does that make sense? Malaria is an example. We've talked about cystic fibrosis, or the sickle cell anemia gene, and how there's a heterozygote advantage. If all individuals were homozygous recessive or homozygous dominant, like most of us are in this classroom, then basically everybody could be wiped out by malaria. Does that make sense? Okay. So the big advantage of sexual reproduction is that there is genetic variation. Now, the last two types of asexual reproduction are a little bit different than the first two. They're probably not quite as common, and they occur. Some people would argue that hermaphrodism is actually a type of modified sexual reproduction. What hermaphrodism is, well, most have you guys heard of hermaphrodites before? Is there such thing as a hermaphroditic human? Regardless of what you hear on Oprah or whatever other daytime talk show you listen to, there is no such thing as hermaphroditic humans. Okay? Humans are either male or female. Either they have a Y chromosome or they don't have a Y chromosome, right? Okay. And so, but what hermaphroditism is it's when an individual can fertilize itself. And there are some organisms that have both male and female reproductive structures in their body. Okay, we're going to talk about, for example, some flatworms later on this semester. And in flatworms, if they can't find a mate, what they actually do is they just insert their own penis into their own vagina and fertilize themselves. Okay, and in humans, that doesn't happen. Okay, because you either have one or the other. All right. Any questions about that? Okay. Another place where hermaphrodism can occur, another example of where it can occur, is in some plants. Most of you have seen that most flowers have both male reproductive parts and female reproductive parts. They can actually fertilize themselves in many instances. Okay, there can be self-fertilization. And in some plants, that's the major way in which they reproduce. There are a whole group of plants that we call selfers as biologists. And what that means is that they're reproducing hermaphroditically. They're fertilizing themselves.
How does a plant do that?
Well, a lot of times it's by chance, especially with the flowers that you think of. So, for example, if a rose bush, there's the female part in the middle of the flower. If a bee comes along and it kind of bends the anther over towards the female part of the plant, if it touches it, it can actually cause pollen to produce, self-produce. There are other plants, a lot of the selfers, they actually don't have big beautiful flowers, but they have more compact flowers. Instead of having petals, their leaves that are really petals that are modified leaves, those specialized leaves are actually circled around the flower. So when they release their pollen, they're typically what we call windborne plants. When they release their pollen, it's kind of trapped in there, and so they fertilize themselves. Any questions about hermaphrodism? The last type of asexual reproduction is parthenogenetic asexual reproduction, and this occurs very rarely, but it does occur in some animals. When animals reproduce parthenogenetically, they typically also reproduce sexually as well. So for example, in bees reproduce both sexually and asexually at the same kind of at the same time. Okay, female bees are actually two N individuals, whereas male bees are just N. Okay, they're one N individuals. And so what happens is when a female bee is formed, we have sperm and an ovum that fuse together, right, and produce a two N individual. Kind of obvious. However, when a bee wants to produce a male bee, what it does is it just has the egg, and the egg develops into an adult without fertilization. Okay. Any questions about that? I actually witnessed this when I was working as a student up at Utah State. I got a job working for a place called the Bee Biology and Systematics Research Laboratory up there, commonly called the Bee Lab, and they do research on bees. Just kind of a side note, one of the most interesting interviews I've ever had in my life. During the interview, they asked me, are you allergic to bee stings? And I told them no. And they said, well, we have to check and make sure. And so they actually bring bees in and you let them sting you. And that's part of the interviewing process, so that you don't die out in the middle of nowhere messing around with bees. So it was kind of fun. But what we were working on is this one particular bee that we were working on was called the blue bottle bee. And they're very important pollinators of apple orchards. They're actually much better pollinators than honeybees. Honeybees are kind of trashy pollinators in a way, because honeybees will go like to a dandelion, then to an apple blossom, then to a tulip, and then to an apple blossom. So they're kind of going between species. Whereas this particular bee we were working on only goes to flowers that are in the family of apples. Okay, so it just goes to those same types of flowers. And so if you introduce these bees into an apple orchard, you can increase your number of apples, almost double the number of apples you get on apple trees, okay, because it increases pollination rates. And so this is a, you know, something that's very interesting to orchard growers, to get these kinds of bees into their orchard. Well, what we didn't understand was these bees that we were working with were solitary bees. Most bees are solitary. They don't live in hives. And actually, these bees, they nest in little holes in the ground. You might have seen bees doing that before. And so the question is, how do we get these bees from one orchard to another, right, so we can increase pollination? Well, in order to understand that, we needed to understand the basic nesting biology of these bees. So what we did was we kind of created an artificial environment for these bees. We built this box out of plywood, and it had holes in it. And then in the holes, we would put little glass tubing. And that would entice the bees to come and make their nests in these little tubes, so they didn't have to dig holes in the floor of the greenhouse. Okay, and so they would fly into this little box. One of my jobs was to sit in this box and wait for the bees to come into these little tubes, and I'd put them underneath a microscope and watch what they would do, and then hurry and get the tube back in the hole before the bee was in my box. Okay, and it was quite fun. It was really interesting. Of course, you know, you slept every so often because you're in this dark box all day. But what I saw was something very interesting. When female bees lay their eggs, they don't copulate with the male every time they're going to lay an egg. What happens in bees is that during copulation, the males put their sperm in a little sac called a spermatheca. That spermatheca is typically up inside of the female reproductive tract. And then when she lays eggs, she'll release some sperm sometimes, and sometimes she won't. And well, this particular bee, what I could see underneath the microscope was that she would exert her spermatheca, which means she would actually come out of the opening, the reproductive opening. And then I would actually see her put her foot down in this little sperm sac or spermatheca. And as the eggs were being laid, some of them she would rub her foot along the eggs. Well, I knew about parthenogenetic asexual reproduction, so I went to the scientist and I said, I bet I can tell you which ones are going to be males and which ones are females. And he didn't think I could do that. He's like, I'll bet you a steak dinner that you can't do that. And come to find out, I could predict over 95% of the time which ones were going to be males and which ones were going to be females. And actually, the scientist wrote a paper on it and everything. But the way that I could tell is that every time the female would put her foot into this spermatheca and then rub it on the egg, I knew that egg was going to be what? A female. Okay? And if the female didn't fertilize the egg, what I was actually seeing was the fertilization or the sex, right? Okay? If the female didn't rub the egg, then I knew it was going to become a male. Does that make sense? So every time that I saw a male egg reproduced, I was watching parthenogenetic asexual reproduction. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. Any questions? So again, advantages and disadvantages of asexual reproduction. The advantages is they can reproduce very quickly, takes less energy. The disadvantages is there's no genetic variation when asexual reproduction occurs. Okay. Now in animals, many times, or most animals have mating systems. This is a little bit different than most other organisms in the world, such as plants and protists and bacteria and fungi. But animals have behavior that's kind of intermixed with reproduction, with sexual reproduction. So what I want to talk about are some different mating systems. There are two major types of mating systems, and actually we'll introduce a third here in a minute. But the first is polygamy. Now, when most of you think of polygamy, you think of manti, right? Okay. Have to give the manti people a hard time. But what you're thinking of is what? One male and many females, right? That is a type of polygamy, but polygamy in general means when there's more than one mate of the opposite sex. So when one individual of one sex mates with more than one individual of the opposite sex. Now I'm going to give you some examples of each of these mating systems, and maybe before I do, I should make the caveat that humans are weird, okay? You can actually find humans that occur in every one of these different types of mating systems. So, you know, you kind of have to use other animals other than humans because we're really weird animals, all right? So there are two major types of polygamy. The first is polygyny and the second is polyandry. Polygyny is what most of you think of when you think of polygamy. So polygyny is a type of polygamy. Polygyny is when one male mates with many females. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, the most common mating system among the animal kingdom is polygyny. Okay. Why?
And they're less males, like a lion or whatever. They have like all the females, and then one male dominant male.
Yeah, they have one female or one dominant male, but actually something interesting, in almost all animals when they're first born, there's about 50% males and 50% females. Yeah?
I was just going to say, usually it's the dominant male because they fought for their place, which means they're the strongest male, which means it'll be easier and there's more of a chance of having cubs that'll live.
Okay, to some extent. In other words, the idea behind it is that females want to do what? Mate with somebody who's going to have good genes, right? And so there's usually some dominant male that has, for some reason or another, is thought to have better genes. Okay, but why? I mean, why can this occur? Well, if you think about gamete formation, how many gametes do males produce? Basically unlimited amounts, right? Okay. And so for a male, from an evolutionary or biological standpoint, the most advantageous situation for a male is to spread your gametes as far and wide as possible, right? Okay. And the more offspring you produce, okay, the better off you are from a biological standpoint, or the more successful you are. Okay, so if you're able to spread your gametes far and wide, then you know, why not do it? Okay, females on the other hand have limited numbers of gametes, correct? Okay, and they have a lot more energy investment into their gametes and into reproduction. And so the idea is that females tend to want to protect their gametes more, and so they're going to actually want to choose which male to reproduce with, okay? And they generally want to choose a very fit male, a male that has some superior characteristic. Does that make sense? And so since there are only a few males with those superior characteristics, we end up with polygynous mating systems. Now, something that typically occurs in polygynous mating systems is something that we call sexual dimorphism. Okay. Sexual dimorphism is when the male and the female have different appearances. Now, let me give you some examples of some different types of sexual dimorphisms. Probably the one that I think of right off the bat, and maybe it's because I'm crazy about hunting elk, is elk, right? What's different about a male and a female elk? Males have antlers, right? Huge antlers, and females don't. We call that in biology weapons. And so possession of weapons is one example of a sexual dimorphism. You can think of probably quite a few animals with that possess weapons that differ between male and female, right? Okay, it can be antlers or horns or some other type of weapon. Okay, any questions about that? All right. Another example of a sexual dimorphism is feather coloration. In birds that reproduce polygynously, and in even some other organisms, the male is much more beautiful than the female. Okay. So that can be a sexual dimorphism. Another example of a sexual dimorphism is body size. In apes, and actually in humans, you can tell the difference between a male and a female just because of body shape and size, right? Okay. So that is a sexual dimorphism. So probably, if you think of humans as having sexual dimorphisms, humans probably evolved polygynously from an evolutionary standpoint. Okay? Any questions about that? And really, humans do have sexual dimorphisms, right? Not only body size, but body shape. Right? I mean, most of the time, about 95% of the time, if you see somebody walking down the road, you can tell whether or not they're male or female. How do you do that? Come on, you guys ought to be able to answer that question, right?
Physical appearance.
What?
Like physical appearance.
Okay, what about your physical appearance? Males generally have what? More muscle mass, right? Okay. Females generally have wider hips, larger breasts. Okay. Those types of things. Okay. So those are sexual dimorphisms. Any questions about polygyny? Actually, the least common mating system is polyandry. That's where one female mates with many males. There's only a couple of species of ground nesting bird that actually have been documented to mate polyandrously. Okay, what happens with these ground nesting birds is the female will get a whole bunch of males to mate with her. The males actually make the nests and brood the young or sit on the eggs. Okay, so what she'll do is she'll spread her eggs around in a bunch of different nests. Kind of the idea, the reason why we think that they've evolved that way is because ground nesting birds are preyed upon quite a bit. Okay, by coyotes, skunks, everything else. So the idea is if the female can put her eggs in a bunch of different baskets, maybe a couple of those baskets survive, kind of an idea. All right. So very uncommon to see a polyandrous type of behavior. Now again, humans are weird. There are polyandrous humans, okay, as well as polygynous ones. Any questions about polygamy, either type of polygamy? Monogamy is when one male mates with one female. Okay. Now, if you think about what we just talked about, why would a male ever want to mate monogamously? I mean, it's a big disadvantage for a male to mate monogamously from a biological standpoint, right? Why would a male ever want to mate monogamously then? Boy, you ladies ought to have questions for this, right?
Ideal of love.
Love doesn't mean anything. From a biological standpoint, it doesn't. Yeah,
there's a lot of cases where the survival is at risk if a male who's committed to be monogamous and hasn't been monogamous in a long time, their survival is.
Actually, you'll be surprised. I'll tell you some stuff later that'll surprise most of you. So why would, I mean, you ladies ought to have a good answer for this, right? Come on, why would a guy ever want to mate monogamously?
Maybe that female has better genes.
It's like guaranteed reproduction if they're always mating the same person out the teeth.
No, not really. I mean, you can. I mean, I'll bet every female in this room could find some guy today to mate with them if they really wanted to. I mean, it's pretty much guaranteed, no matter what, right? You understand what I'm saying? I mean, boy, I'm glad you ladies have a good answer for this. Okay. Really, if you think about it, the organisms that reproduce monogamously all have one thing in common, and it's their young. Okay, the young of organisms that mate monogamously take tremendous amounts of parental investment. Right? In other words, if mom were to just raise that young, the young probably wouldn't survive. It takes too much energy. Okay, so dad has to be around and help raise the young. And so what happens is if the male just mates with the female and then leaves, has sex and then leaves, his genes are probably not going to be passed on to the next generation because of what? The young's probably not going to survive. Does that make sense? In order to pass its genes on. And so generally we find that monogamous relationships occur between organisms that have young that take tremendous amount of parental investment. Also with monogamous relation, or organisms that mate monogamously, we generally, well, we never see sexual dimorphisms. Okay? So I can give you a couple of examples of organisms that mate monogamously. When you go out and you see the bald eagles this time of the year, can you tell whether or not they're male or female? Mm-hmm. No, there's no sexual dimorphism. When I go swan hunting or goose hunting in the fall, when they fly over, can I tell which one's a male and which one's a female? Can't. They both look the same. Does that make sense? Okay. So organisms that mate monogamously tend not to have sexual dimorphisms. Now, one thing that's really interesting about monogamous relationships is among humans, monogamy has been over romanticized, and that's kind of why I kind of left off the one love comment. You've heard stories where organisms that mate monogamously, they mate for life, and you know, if something happens to the one mate, they go on lonely, and the whole, you know, sappy romantic idea. That has nothing to do with reality, okay? In reality, very few organisms mate for life, okay? If one of the pair dies, the other individual will go find another mate. We see divorces, essentially, in the wild kingdom. Generally, what monogamy means is that you're just mating with one mate for the mating season. In most species that mate monogamously, they will find a different mate every mating season. They won't mate with the same individual. Does that make sense? So, the romanticized ideas of monogamy are really kind of not true. Right? One other thing about monogamy that's really interesting. In organisms that mate monogamously, if one of the two in the pair are going to cheat, which is it that cheats, the male or the female? About 98% of the time it's the female, okay? Females are almost always the ones that cheat. Males aren't going to cheat because they've made this investment in just having one mate, okay? And so actually in organisms that mate monogamously, when the female cheats, we call her a colcoid, okay? Or a cuckold, either way of saying it. And so there's something that's called anti-colcoidary behavior among males. And so in most organisms that mate monogamously, the male has to beat the female into submission or she will go and cheat. All right? And in fact, in most monogamous relationships, the males that raise the young only are the true biological fathers of the young about 50% of the time, because the females are so likely to go out and cheat with a better looking guy, so to speak.
What's an example of an animal that does that?
Almost all animals that reproduce monogamously do.
Like, what's an animal that
do? Geese, swans, eagles. Okay. Yeah,
humans. Is that statistic true with humans too?
Like I said, humans are weird. Okay. But in pretty much all animal In the animal kingdom, the most likely individual to cheat is the female. Okay. In finches, you see the same sort of thing. So what the males have to do is the females will want to take off and cheat, and the males have to kind of beat them up. You'll see them pecking on the females and kind of keeping them under their thumb, so to speak, so they don't cheat. Okay. Any questions about that? There's another type of, it's not really a mating system, and that's why I didn't list it up here, but it's important to mention it. And that is what we call promiscuity. Okay, some organisms mate promiscuously. And what that means is that organisms that mate promiscuously, if they meet up with an individual of the opposite sex, they're just going to mate just because they meet up with somebody from the opposite sex. Okay, mice are like this and rabbits are. They're at what we call coitus-induced ovulators. And so like rabbits and mice, the female doesn't ovulate until after coitus or copulation. And so they'll just kind of mate with whoever they meet with out on the road kind of thing. All right. Any questions about that? The reason why promiscuity is somewhat common in some of the, I guess you could say, smaller mammals especially, is because they have very short generation periods. So the females can have multiple batches of young in a very short period of time. Okay. Any questions about mating systems? And again, kind of remember that you know, humans are weird. You can find humans that are polygynous, polyandrous, monogamous, and promiscuous, right? Okay. Any questions about mating systems? Okay. So let's start talking a little bit about evolution. A population, before we do, we need to define a couple of terms, I should say. A population are all the members of a species that occupy a particular area at the same time. So when we talk about populations of organisms, population really includes a number of things. It includes a type of organism, an area, and a time. Okay. So for example, if I were to ask you, what's the population of humans? That wouldn't make any sense, right? Okay. Because you would have to say something like, what is the population of humans in this room on whatever date it is? I haven't looked at the calendar day. What's the 27th or something like that? On the 27th of February. Okay. That would be, we could actually determine the population of humans in this room today, kind of a thing. But to ask, what is the population of humans? Well, you could ask the question, in North America and the whole world today, 10 years ago, 100 years ago. Does that make sense? So when we talk about populations, it has to have a species, place, and time associated with it. All right. Associated with the population is something that we call a gene pool. A gene pool is all of the genes and all of the members of a population. Okay. So the population of humans in this room today has a gene pool, and that consists of all of our genes. All right? Any questions? Now, we're going to have a very simple definition of evolution. Evolution is the change of a population's gene pool over time. Okay? So evolution is the change in the frequency of genes in a population's gene pool from one generation to the next. Okay. Very simple definition of evolution. Now, we'll actually talk about two main types, or kind of two main topics in evolution, I guess you could say. One is what we call microevolution, and one is what we call macroevolution. Micro means small, of course, macro means large. Evolution, just this basic definition of evolution, is generally referred to as microevolution. Macroevolution is trying to describe how, over a long period of time, organisms have changed from simpler organisms to more complex organisms. Okay. Evolution does occur. Right. I mean, there is no question that it does, and I'll show you some examples of that here in a minute. Maybe not today, but when most of you, when you think of evolution, you think of the father of kind of what, who's considered the father of evolution, the person who introduced the idea. What's his name?
Darwin.
And when you think of Darwin, you typically think of the idea of monkey to man kind of evolution. That would be an example of macroevolution. And actually, Darwin extrapolated talking about macroevolution a little bit, but his main theory of evolution dealt with what we would normally think of as microevolution, or the definition that I have here. At the same time that Darwin was around, there were other people that were also thinking about this idea of evolution, of a changing gene pool from one generation to the next. There's a scientist whose name was Wallace. Some people think that Wallace is the first person to come up with the idea of evolution, where evolution is the changing of a gene pool from one generation to the next. However, Wallace wasn't a very good writer, and Darwin was one of those types of people that used to write all the time and was really a gregarious person, went out and talked to a lot of people and so forth. And a lot of people think that Darwin actually stole Wallace's ideas. That's, I guess, open to debate from a historical standpoint. At the same time, there was another scientist that was also kind of thinking about evolution. His name was Lamarck. And Lamarck and Darwin had some different ideas about evolution. Lamarck thought that individuals could evolve. Whereas Darwin said, individuals can evolve, it's populations that evolve over time. So kind of let me give you an example of the difference between the two trends of thought and why Lamarckism was, we actually rejected Lamarck's hypothesis, okay? Lamarck had the idea that, say for example, if you had a population of giraffes, and all the leaves on the trees were very high up in the air, if the giraffe stretched its neck, it could actually get a longer neck over time if it kept stretching its neck. And then it could pass that characteristic onto its offspring. Okay? In other words, the idea that individuals could evolve. And what we found over time is that that doesn't occur. In some ways I kind of wish that it did. If it did, I would go hang on a swing set and stretch my arms out so I could make $1 million in the NBA or multi-millions pretty easily, being a shot blocker and a rebounder, and then have my kids also be rich because I would pass those long arms on to my kids. Okay? So individuals cannot evolve. And over time, what we found was that Darwin's idea of evolution was actually a little bit more accurate. Darwin said if you have these trees that have the leaves that are very high up, and you have a population of giraffes, the giraffes that have longer necks to begin with are going to be able to reach the leaves, and they're going to be more healthy, and therefore they're going to do what? Be more likely to be the ones who reproduce. Okay? And so if they're more likely to reproduce, then in the next generation, you should have more giraffes with longer necks. Okay? There's still going to be some short neck giraffes, and they're essentially going to starve to death or not be as healthy. And so again, the taller or the longer neck giraffes are going to survive and pass their genes on to the next generation. So in the next generation, you should have a population of even taller giraffes. Okay. So his idea was that evolution occurs when the gene pool of the population changes from one generation to the next. Okay. Any questions about that? Now with that definition in mind, do humans evolve? Has our population evolved over, let's say, the last 50 years? Yeah, in what way can you think of? Unfortunately, you're not smarter than your parents. Even though my 14-year-old daughter thinks that I'm pretty stupid right now, but
I think height is one of our best.
Yeah, height is a good example.
People just get taller because that's what they prefer, people prefer population.
Yeah, and so what happens is if you look at the average height of individuals 50 years ago versus today, 50 years ago, the average height of a human male was probably around 5'9". Okay? Today, average height is about 6'1". Okay? Any questions about that? So why is that happening?
Survival is life.
Actually, it's not so much survival of the fittest, but it's who can what. A lot of people say evolution is survival of the fittest, and that's really not accurate. It's not really, because short guys are just as likely to survive, right? But what is it? It's the tall guys, really what we should call it is the most prolific reproducers are able to pass their genes on, okay? So what happens is, for some reason, human females have decided that tall guys are better to mate with, better to have offspring with, right? Okay, and so most more human females want to mate with taller guys. Okay, and so if you're a taller guy, your chances of reproducing actually are much greater than if you're a shorter guy. Sorry, shorter guys. Okay. So you're already at a disadvantage because females like taller guys. And actually, that's not the only story. Actually, guys tend to like taller girls as well. Did you know that? In humans. So if you're a taller girl, you're more likely to have kind of your pick of the bunch. All right. Any questions about that? Okay. So kind of keep that in the back of your mind when we talk about evolution. Evolution is really just a change in the frequency of a population's gene pool over time, right? And there are multiple ways in which evolution can occur. On Friday, we're going to talk about lines of evidence for evolution, okay? In other words, why do we think that evolution is occurring? What are some of the evidentiary reasoning behind evolution, okay? Any questions about that? And if you think, you know, what happens, this is just kind of one parting thought. There's a lot of debate out there about the idea of evolution, right, versus creationism in the media, okay? What you need to realize is that we can scientifically prove that evolution occurs. It's just that people don't have a proper definition of evolution. People don't really understand evolution. They think evolution is... when they think of evolution, they only think of macroevolution rather than microevolution. And microevolution is very easy to show. So, yeah.
Can they prove that
the can we prove it? Well, you can't prove anything in science. You can only prove that it's not. And it hasn't been proven that we're not. Okay?